1981. So in 1981, my Friedman here just had proved the four-dimensional Poincaré conjecture. And this was a really big deal because at that time, topologists were uniformly embarrassed by their lack of knowledge of the fourth dimension. In fact, when I would have friends to bring to a topology party, and they were wondering, you know, what are they going to do at this topologist party, I'd tell them, this is the way you do it. You go up to a knot of topologists who are talking to each other, and you just sit there and you nod knowingly for a minute, and then you say, but what about dimension four? At which all the topologists fall silent and look at their feet in an embarrassed kind of manner.
And that's so changed?
At this time, I don't know. And then you can say, have you read any good books lately? And the evening is set. So in this setting, proving the four-dimensional Poincaré conjecture was really amazing and is amazing. It's a real tour de force in mathematics. Well, when he proved this theorem, he came here to the University of Texas where the R.H. Bing was then a prominent person in the department, because Mike had used some of the techniques that R.H. Bing had pioneered in the proof of the four-dimensional Poincaré conjecture. So Cameron was there, and we're very delighted to have Bob Edwards, who was there, and Rick Ansell was there. Some people from across the country came for this series of talks. And Mike Friedman gave this series of talks, which took about a week, as I recall, in great detail. This was none of this business of saying, oh, it sounds pretty good. We were getting every single detail. Is that right?
All the ones
that knew. All the ones that knew. No. We forced him to do even the ones he did not know. So that was it. In any case, so the outcome of this was that, and I was active in the seminar at the time, and so Mike invited me to spend a sabbatical with him at UC San Diego, where he was at the time. So the next year, I spent the winter and spring quarters there, and we began working on a question about Bing's wild evolution of the three-sphere, having to do with its analytic properties. You know, how does the topological wildness reflect itself analytically? Well, we were unable to solve it. Very sad. It was very, very sad. We were unable to solve it. Fast forward to fall of 2020. So in the fall of 2020, that's 2 years ago, Mike was asked to give a seminar at Harvard that included this work on his Poincaré conjecture and other things. And so, because of COVID, he was going to be on Zoom. And so we sent out an email to a bunch of us people who were involved in the four-dimensional Poincaré conjecture and saying, if you'd like to join, just sign up and do so. And so I did. And Rick, did you do that? Bob, were you there? I don't know who was there. Anyway, I don't know who was there because it was Zoom. Yeah. In any case, so Mike gave this nice talk, and I was very polite, and so I sent an email to Mike, and I said, Mike, I really enjoyed thinking about all these old ideas that I remember so fondly, and that was such fun. To which he responded. He said, do you think we're smarter than we were? Well, the answer to that was obvious. I wrote back, I said, of course we're smarter than we were. Duh. And he said, okay, let's see if we can solve this problem that we had started working on 40 years before. And that was, or 38 years before at that time. And now it's been 40 years, and what Mike is going to talk about now is our success proving two things. One, this feature about the wild evolutions of the three-sphere, and two, that you definitely get smarter as you get older. But now I will proceed with the introduction of Mike. So Mike is a very accomplished person. He's won all kinds of awards, which I have written here. One is the Fields Medal. Won the Fields Medal. He won a Sloan and Guggenheim Fellowships, MacArthur Fellowship, National Medal of Science. Tell me if I go wrong on any. National Academy of Sciences, American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Fields Medal and he was the director of Station Q, Microsoft Station Q, which works on quantum topological quantum computing. And he did get a PhD. He got a PhD at Princeton. He's still working on his BA. And I hope that he gets it sometime in the next 10 or 20 years. So I give you my freedom.
Some new technique developed that you exploited. I said, no. He says, well, look, I know you're not smarter than you were 40 years ago. I know that. So what changed? And I was kind of puzzled, and it took me a while to think about it. And I think the answer is I finally started listening to Mike. When we worked on this before, I expected to have all the answers, but it turns out the way the proof worked is when we were in hot water, which happened several times, Mike always had the right idea, and it was just necessary to listen. So I've become a better listener. Okay, so what is all this about? Let me start back in the 19th century with the Jordan Curves data. So Jordan Curve Theorem is about loops, one-to-one maps of a circle into a plane, but you shouldn't think of them as smooth or piecewise linear. You should think of the difficult case as some, you know, very rigid curve. And the Jordan Curve Theorem says that if you have such a thing, there's an inside and an outside, so it separates the plane into two connected regions. But this was quickly enhanced in 1913 by a contribution from Cara Theodori. And that's what I'll write on the board here. So if you have a circle, S1, and this little hooked arrow means it's embedded into the plane. It's a one-to-one map into the plane. But we can also think of the circle as embedded into the boundary of the two-disc. It is the boundary of the two-disc. And in diagrammatic notation, this extension of the Jordan Curve Theorem is that whenever you have a map, an embedding of a circle into the plane, it extends to an embedding of the disk in the plane. So, you know, this is basically some complex analysis. Cara Theodori is a complex analyst, and it was understood, you know, from the Jordan Curve Theorem that there was an inside and an outside. It was understood that the inside was simply connected, so it was understood that it was parameterized by an essentially unique map, conformal map from the disk. But there was the difficult question of boundary regularity. Would this map from the open disk, the uniformalizing map, would that converge continuously to the boundary? It's a very non-trivial point, and that's where the one-to-oneness is important. And he introduced a concept which is still important in one single complex variable. It's called extremal length. Length of curve families kind of cutting off next. He was able to prove this theorem. By the way, you might wonder, why would mathematicians even have been worried about weakly curves? You know, why weren't they satisfied with smooth curves? In the 19th century, people had already been studying complex dynamics. Fuchsian groups were the topic. And so mathematicians were well aware of these non-differentiable things that come up very naturally in dynamics. So it was a natural question. You know, this would be like the domain of discontinuity in here and it's set up here. Well, maybe the next item in the story is 1922. The American mathematician, John Alexander, announced, but did not publish, but announced that the same thing was true one higher dimension. That is, if you have a one-to-one map of a two-sphere into three space, that there'd be a corresponding map of the three-ball, filling it in. Now, professional mathematicians, many of you and students who probably, who may not already have experienced this, but surely will. You're familiar with the sinking feeling when you said something a little too quickly. We all think we know a lot of stuff, and we're quick to thought that like hear our voices or our professors. But sometimes, after a little reflection, we're not so sure of what we said. And this must have happened to Alexander, because in 1924, he published his very famous Alexander Horn Spear, which will be a leading topic today. And it's a counterexample to this claim that you can just bump up the dimensions one. So it's an embedding of the two spear in the three space, where you can't put a ball in on one side. In the picture I'll draw, it's the outside that doesn't accept a ball. So let me draw the Alexander Horn Spear. Many of you have seen pictures of it. I'll draw it in a way that's not usually drawn, but it emphasizes kind of a braided aspect. And this is a picture I learned from Bob Edwards in 1980. let's draw a picture of a sphere in three space. So for reference, I'm going to draw the round sphere and correspond the regions of my picture in the image to regions on the round sphere source. So I'm going to take this kind of temperate latitudes and map it into this U-shaped cylinder. And then in the northern region and the southern region, I'm going to put in a pair of pants. So it's not the full cap, but it's a cap minus 2 points. So that could be drawn like this. So far, so good. But I'm going to introduce a little wrinkle or twist, which is I'm going to braid the middle two of the four arms around each other. Okay, so that's the map on this much. And then we proceed, as you often do in topology, once you've thought of something interesting, you just do it forever. So we'll fill these in with a pair of pants, and we'll do exactly the same thing, that these two on the top and these two on the bottom that we did with the initial two. So, of course, it takes exponentially long to draw these pictures. So I'll use a little bit of shorthand here. This one branches, and we'll braid the middle two around each other. I won't draw the picture. Maybe it's carefully as I should have. Same thing down here. And then, of course, it goes on forever. Talk to the there are four cases, each of which bifurcates again. Again, there's braiding on the subsequence. And in the limit, there's a Cantor set. And what this Cantor set is are sort of the residual points of the two sphere that are left over, the uncountable number of points that are the infinite intersection of these nested disks. Or if you like, they're the part of the two sphere that's not contained in the infinite union of these pairs of pants. And its embedding is defined by this picture, except on the limit, on the Cantor sets, and there it's defined the only way it could be to keep it continuous. So you have to send that Cantor set to these limit points. And this is the Alexander Horn sphere. You could make the horns point inward if you wanted, instead of outward. And again, there'd be some braiding. And if you did that, then this closed region inside would be called the Alexander Horn ball. But, you know, as topologists, we often put things in three space and add a point at infinity. We always think of the construction in the three sphere. So there's, we can just as well regard this as an example in the three sphere, and then the inside is actually just V3. There's nothing wild about the inside. And you can see that because the same kind of tin can picture that I used to describe the boundary can be used to describe an embedding, an extended embedding from the inside. I can take this middle region of the Earth and send it here. I can take this solid pair of pants and send it here and take the limit. So the inside is a ball, topologically a ball, it's homeomorphic to the ball. But the outside, this complementary, closed complementary region of the Alexander horn ball in this picture. So you can't put the horns on the outside of the syndrome, but then the thing that's called the Alexander horn ball is on the outside. Now, maybe a possible explanation, if you look at Alexander's 1924 paper, he mentions the Antoine necklace there. So let me remind you of this. In 1914, Antoine published an interesting Cantor set, a knotted Cantor set, if you like. It's a subset of R3. It's called the Antoine necklace. And let's see if I, let me use this part of the blackboard for the necklace. So the Antoine necklace, what you should do, again, it's an infinite construction, and you start with a solid torus in three space, and then you put four solid tori inside it, according to sort of a daisy chain. So I drew these as circles, but each one is really supposed to be a solid torus. Think of the chalk as having some thickness. And now you're probably getting the idea that topologists have this obsessive thing of not thinking of anything new, just doing what they did previously over and over and really often. So you can imagine taking inside each of these four solid torus, four more with the same pattern, and then take the infinite intersection. So the Antoine necklace could be written as the intersection of I equals 0 or 1 to infinity of these stages. And this stage is like 4 to the I solid torus. It, according to this pattern. So the first 4 to the 0 is 1. The first stage is the 0 stage is just this one solid torus. Then the next stage is drawn. The next stage would be 16 solid tori. I didn't draw those. And the thing that you can see is that these tori, each, I didn't draw the most symmetrical picture in the world, but you can imagine each one has like 60% of the diameter of the previous stage. So there's a geometric series that says the connected components of the infinite intersection have zero size. The whole thing just shrinks down to a point. So the infinite intersection is a Cantor set, but it's exotic, and it's unlike this Cantor set we saw in the two-sphere, which was defined by two-dimensional disks intersecting. This is not defined by three-dimensional disks, but by solid tori. This Cantor set cannot be defined by the intersection of balls.
And in that sense, it's called wild. So that was the purpose of Antoine's example, to show a wild Cantor set, though I don't think the word wild existed in this sense. And I think a very reasonable guess is that Alexander discovered his mistake and found the Alexander horn sphere by just kind of contemplating the problem, which can't be solved, of taking a meridional curve on the outside solid torus and trying to find a disk which gets in there and misses the Antoine necklace. It won't work, but if you try to avoid the different stages, you start to see these arms come up and entangle. All right, well, there's a very powerful tool which I want to talk about in wild topology called decomposition space theory. And in a nutshell, what it is you consider, in the simplest case, compact metric spaces. So let's say X and Y are compact metric. And you consider some surjection, so just an onto map from X to Y. And one wants to ask the question, when is such a map approximable by homeomorphisms? We'll abbreviate this, approximable by homeomorphisms. You know, so a very simple example of this is X could be a disk and Y could be a disk. And you could imagine a map which took an interval, like, say, the unit interval on the X-axis, and just crushed it to a point. You could make this quotient space. And you could ask, well, this map is not a homeomorphism because this whole interval goes to a point. It's one-to-one elsewhere. But you can kind of see that it can be approximated by maps that squeeze this interval not quite to a point, but to very short intervals. You can get a convergent sequence of homeomorphisms. So another way of thinking about this situation is that the language, decomposition space language, is D, is a disjoint union of closed sets. We'll call them subsets, closed subsets of X. And then with the property that the union, well, maybe I'll just write it this way, the union over D is all of X. So it's a collection, maybe countably many, maybe uncountably many. Some of the subsets are just points. But if you divide X into these closed pieces, then you can take what's called the quotient space. You can divide out and if there's, you don't place any condition on these closed sets, you won't get a very nice result. The natural topology is called the quotient topology, which is the strongest topology, making the projection map continuous. It's actually quite a condition on this D that the quotient be metrizable. But if it is metrizable, then you're kind of in Bing's world and you start asking the question, when is this, or you're in decomposition space land, and you can ask whether this map, this quotient map, is approximable by homeomorphisms. So I want to give you a very concrete example of a decomposition, and it's another way of thinking about the Alexander Horn sphere. So it's good that it's still up on the board. So let's just start with a round sphere. And let's think of a solid cylinder sticking out here to the right, like this. And I'll draw it kind of with a long top hat on it in this direction for a reason that will become evident. And I'll call this C1. It's simply, topologically, it's just D2 cross I. It's just a tin can. It's a solid cylinder. But I want it to have this geometry, the way it hangs on the sphere. And then consider inside it C2, And C2 will consist of two solid cylinders. Sort of like I've drawn them. But just as I did with the picture of the Alexander Horn sphere, I'm going to, I probably should be using colored chalk, I'm going to braid these arms. So I'm going to take, there are four sort of tubes here, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm going to braid 2 and 3 like this. And now that's C2. So C2 is equal to 2 copies of D2 cross I, but embedded as drawn. And C3 would be 4 copies of D2 cross I, so on dyadically. And now, suppose you imagine, like, evacuating these solid cylinders, just sucking the air out like a vacuum, and imagine the two spheres a membrane, and it can be sort of distorted. And you'll pull out these horns, and the horns will braid around each other, just as in that picture. Now, you can define the decomposition, I'll write it script C, as the components of the intersection, the infinite intersection, I equals 1 to infinity, of these CIs. And the way I've arranged things here, it's not hard to see that if you draw a picture like this, that the components of each connected component of script C is an arc. But there's a Cantor set worth of them because they're parameterized by this Cantor set of points on the sphere. So script C, just colloquially, I'll call it a Cantor set of arcs. And I can form the decomposition space. I can just take R3, or S3, it doesn't matter. Take R3 and divide out by C. And all these arcs can be compressed, can be shrunk to the right, to their right endpoints. And this does not change the topology. This quotient space, if you like, in the previous language, this quotient map is approximable by homeomorphisms. And it's really an easy limiting argument based on just pulling things to the right. But what it does do is it transports, it creates a, what it does do is it repositions the, in the quotient space, the round 2 sphere is no longer, if you take the actual quotient, not an approximating homeomorphism, but if you take the actual quotient, the round 2 sphere becomes the Alexander Horn sphere. So I'll write that down as in quotient, S2 goes to Alexander Horn sphere. And maybe what's even more interesting is if we consider this thing happening not in R3, but in S3. So if we add the point at infinity, then the exterior in the quotient, so the exterior B3 in this quotient is transformed and becomes the Alexander Horn ball. So the purpose of this board here is just to explain this example, the Horn sphere, the Alexander Horn ball, in a different language of decomposition spaces, seeing it as coming from the most standard objects by dividing something out. Now, Bing would not have said it in this way, but his intuition about what was functorial comes into play here. That is, the three sphere, so what we know is that if you take the three ball and you divide, this is the exterior three ball, and you divide out by C, script C, you get the Alexander Horn ball. But you can take the three sphere, which is just the double of the three ball. The double means you take two disjoint copies of the three ball and you identify their boundaries by the identity. You can take the three sphere and divide it now by the double of C. And then in the quotient, this quotient becomes S3 modulo, it'll deserve its own name, the double of C, I'm going to write as script D, and this is going to be what's called the Bing decomposition. And it's actually looks a lot like Antoine's necklace. I'm glad that's still on the board. So I drew C as an intersection of solid cylinders. But what happens to a solid cylinder if you double it along, not its whole boundary, but you double it along the part of its boundary that's in the, that's being doubled along when the ball is turned into the three sphere. And that part of the boundary is these two disks. So when you double a solid cylinder along two disks, you get a solid torus. And when you double the next stage, which topologically looks like this, next stage solid cylinder, you get two solid cylinders, which are named after Bing, and it's called a Bing pair, or a Bing double. So now we have something very interesting, kind of a closed topological situation, where we have, it's really like classical link theory. It's actually, this is example is really the Borromean rings. If you think of this solid torus as the complement of something going in this direction, this three-component link is a famous thing. It's the Borromean rings. And Bing says, we'll just keep going. This is the functoriality I was talking about, that D is the infinite intersection of of 2 to the I solid tori. And also equal the double of the previous decomposition, which is the intersection of 2 to the I solid cylinders. Notice the similarity. This is the Antoine necklace, except the 4 in the Antoine necklace has become 2 in the case of Bing double. The daisy chains have length 2 rather than length 4. Now, even 3 is enough for the Antoine necklace. If you arrange things in the, sort of the obvious way, the diameters of those three things will all get smaller and smaller. But it doesn't seem to be happening here. It seems hard to make the diameters get smaller. But this is kind of the heroic moment in the story when R.H. Bing, 1952, realized that this quotient is actually homeomorphic to S3. That is the projection map where you start with a three sphere and divide out by this decomposition is approximable by homeomorphisms. So this example really was one of the foundational pillars of what I learned as a young man was called Texas topology. Now, I learned this afternoon Bing was actually in Wisconsin when he wrote this paper, but he definitely counts as a Texan. He was born in Oakwood, Texas, and I learned from his protégés in this department that he was a math teacher, high school math teacher, and football coach. And it's Enlightenment, the Texas legislature after World War II passed a law that if high school teachers went back to college and got a master's degree, they would earn $350 a year more from the state. And Bing thought this was a good deal, and he went to UT, and he entered Moore's seminar, and the rest is history. You know, this was a seminar, by the way, where you were supposed to think of everything yourself. You weren't told stuff. There was no didaction. You just had to figure each thing out. And that was the method, and Bing excelled. And what I'm going to show you, his reasoning on this, you'll see why he might have done well in such a class. So the problem before us right now is, can you shrink this thing? That is, I have to tell you the rules. What you're supposed to do is imagine this descending nest of solid tori, and you're allowed to reposition any way you want by homeomorphism the nth plus first stage within the nth. And then once you've repositioned the nth plus first, you're allowed to reach in there and move the nth plus second within the repositioned nth plus first. And you keep doing this, and what your goal is to do is to make this Cantor set of arcs become a Cantor set of points, a real Cantor set. You're supposed to shrink them to points. And doing that is the essence of showing that this quotient map is approximal by homeomorphisms, and more fundamentally that the quotient space is just your old familiar friend. But once you do that, the two-sphere will be messed up, even worse than in this example, in a different way. But to justify the title of the talk, involution, since this thing has a doubled structure, it's the three-sphere is the double of the ball divided by the double of this, it's really just, this quotient is just two copies of the ball modulo C, which is the Alexander Horn ball. So this quotient space is two copies of the same thing glued together along the two-sphere, along their basically boundary. So it obviously has an involution because the two copies can just be switched. So this thing has an involution. There's nothing tricky there. The tricky thing is that the space on which this involution is acting can be thought of as the three-sphere, not this weird quotient topology. So that's kind of the genius, half the genius. And then the other half is, how do you shrink this? Well, I want to show you Bing's argument. It's really worth seeing in full. So Bing realized that this is really a one-dimensional problem. Up to homeomorphism, you can assume your torus is spread out sort of long in one direction and negligibly thick in the other directions. And actually, I made a mistake by not leaving myself enough room to draw even the first stage. So let me draw the torus this way. So now what he said to do is take a large number of planes, think 10 or 100, parallel planes equally spaced, cutting the figure like this. And he's going to try to rearrange the stages to span so that any stage a component of any stage spans fewer planes as you go to deeper stages. So just look at the first picture. I'll draw the first stage in blue, and I'll rotate the clasp, if you like, around like so. So instead of the clasps being at the extreme left and right edge, I've rotated so that the blue tori cross one fewer plane than the outside torus. So the top blue torus didn't cross this leftmost plane, and the bottom blue torus did not cross this rightmost plane. And now what do I do for the tori inside the blue? Well, it's symmetrical, so let me just focus on the lower blue torus. And because the picture will get kind of tight, I'll just mark kind of the turning points. So what I want to do is now miss the first two planes on the left. So I'll turn here, and I'll kind of go like this. And then have another turning point here. You know what would be really helpful? Is one of these red tori should be orange. Okay, it's supposed to be inside the blue torus, but I wasn't skilled enough to get it inside. Okay, but I think you can see if you look at the orange torus, it it misses one additional plane on the left, and the red torus misses one additional plane on the right. Even though it squiggles back and forth a lot here on the left, that's not a concern. Notice we're not making these tori shorter in terms of the length of their core circle. That's staying the same, but we are working on their diameter. So they're just getting folded up and getting less and less diameter. Now, you might wonder if there isn't a simpler way to do this. Like, suppose you adopted, and I'm sure Bing tried this first, suppose you say, well, let's be aggressive. Let's not just try to miss one plane. Let's miss half the planes by folding the torus in red, blue, by folding the torus in the middle, like this. Okay, that's great. We've gone from N to N over 2. But once your blue torus is in this completely folded place, notice there's no way to make progress at the next stage. There's no way to define two turning points where these cross any fewer planes. So I'm not saying this approach is a dead end, and it turns out not to be. There's a subtlety around here. But at least the obvious thing doesn't work. And Bing's genius was to be patient and invent this approach. And actually, the theorem I'm going to tell you about that Mike and I proved actually plays off two things. It plays off an exponential function, which is that the number of tori is going like 2 to the n, and the diameters of these tori is going like 1 over n. So this thing is going to infinity very fast, and this thing is going to zero slowly, only harmonically, and you'll see how this is going to be important in a minute. Well, now, actually, once you get the foundations of the subject running smoothly, as Bob Edwards did in his beautiful ICM talk in 1978, which is a great place to learn about Texas topology, once you get this running smoothly, it turns out that once you show how to make the diameters smaller than a given epsilon, it's easy to make them go to zero. That turns out to be bare category theorem. But Bing actually didn't think of it that way, and he actually had a psychological hurdle. And I asked him about this in 1981 when I was in Texas. I said, well, this only gets you to size 1 over n. You got to get these things to zero. And by the time you're done, these last stages, they're all wound up like this. What are you going to do? And he answered me like a football coach. He says, when you're in the gym and you're climbing the rope, he says, it does you no good at all once you've pulled up just to keep on pulling. That gets you nowhere. You got to let go with one hand and grab it again. And that, enough said. You know, I mean, that's the answer. Because when this thing is all folded up in this miserable coil like this, or however it's folded, you replace this idea of n planes with a billion times n planes, or a billion to the n times planes. A huge number of planes, but they're not full parallel planes. They're just little tick marks along the folded stage. You just draw all these new tick marks in, and those count as your new planes. You now start to measure length according to how many of these are crossed, and you reduce one at a time the number you cross each time you double the number of tori. So you have to be very patient, because if your objective function is to reduce the diameter, you see that nothing happens for the longest while until you get very near the end of this process, and then finally you have stages that only cross one of the tick marks, and they're indeed small. So it's a laborious process. But that was Bing's argument. So maybe a last picture is we can kind of draw what this looks like, the Bing involution. We can draw what the fixed set looks like, at least sort of schematically, by thinking that we have a geodesic two-sphere in S3, or a separating plane in R3. It doesn't matter how you draw it. And you have these stages, these tori, perpendicular to it. And this is the pre-shrunk picture. This is before you shrink, and the reflection is just the usual reflection in a hyperplane. But in order to understand what the fixed set of the Bing involution looks like, you can approximate it by not going all the way to wildness, not fully shrinking to points, but just starting the procedure. And what is the procedure? It's kind of grabbing these sub-tori and rotating them in previous tori. And when you grab and start rotating and stretching, what happens is these little bits of planar disk, they get feelers poked out like this from rotating this way, and then another feeler poked out some length this way. And maybe these feelers link each other even. They start linking each other. That's just at the first stage. Then when you go to the second stage, each feeler end gets two spots on it, and one of them may push this way, and the other push this way. And these feelers, just proliferate and link with each other, hook around each other. And in the limit, that's the fixed set. And the theorem, so let me write the theorem finally. The theorem is about, as Mike said in his introduction, about the analytical properties of such an involution. Now, in constructing this shrink, it's quite clear I've made choices. I just showed you one way to shrink. There are many ways to shrink. And even if you follow this basic pattern, there'll be many details about how to extend the picture to an ambient isotopy and all this. So it's fair to say there is no specific Bing shrink. There's really no preferred coordinate system to look at the Bing shrink in. So the discussion is really about the topological conjugacy class of the Bing involution. All things in the topological conjugacy class have a right to be called the Bing involution. So I'll let H be a homeomorphism from S3 to S3. I is one of the Bing involutions. Just pick your favorite. And then the theorem, which is that Mike mentioned, is that for all conjugacy class, all elements of the conjugacy class, so for all I to the H, this means H inverse I H, the modulus of continuity which we'll abbreviate Mach of the involution satisfies delta inverse must grow very fast with respect to epsilon inverse. It must be larger than 1.08 raised to the square root of epsilon inverse. So let me explain what this notation means. Epsilon and delta are the absolutely familiar epsilons and deltas from the definition of continuity. The definition of continuity is to control the behavior of a function in the target. To keep points within epsilon of the target, you have to ensure that they're within delta in the source. So a function is defined to be continuous if, for every epsilon greater than zero, there is a delta, so that if you're within delta, the image points are within epsilon. But this begs the question, what's the functional relationship between epsilon and delta? For instance, a Lipschitz function is a function where delta is linear in epsilon. The amount of stretching is linear. That's called the Lipschitz constant. Holder, it's a power. In this case, it's more stretching than a power. It's not like epsilon inverse to a power. It's exponential in epsilon inverse, or at least its square root. So I've chosen this notation. We chose this notation in the paper of thinking of delta inverse as a function of epsilon inverse. We could have phrased this theorem in terms of delta as a function of epsilon, but that would have confused us, because what we wanted to think is we wanted to think that the more stretching, the faster something was growing, not the more stretching, the slower something had to be growing. It's just psychological. It seems easier to discuss epsilon delta inverse as a function of epsilon inverse than delta as a function of epsilon. So in particular, this answers some question that's been in the literature: is could the Bing involution be in some coordinates Lipschitz, by Lipschitz involution? The answer is no. Could it be quasi-conformal? The answer is no, because K quasi-conformal maps are 1 over K Holder continuous, and Holder is more regular than what we find. Now, in some sense, this theorem looks like it should be easy, because it's based on the following. It's actually based on the picture of these feelers, which I was starting to erase. So let me put one of these feelers back. Remember I told you that the essence of the proof was going to be comparing exponential with harmonic. So at the nth stage, at least if you draw the most regular standard picture imaginable, like the original Bing shrink, these little feelers will stick out something like 1 over n. That'll be this linear dimension at the nth stage. The distance between two parallel planes in that picture, that's sort of how far you have to rotate, how far the fixed set will be pushed. But how many of these feelers are there? They're exponentially many. There's 2 to the n of these feelers. The number of feelers is 2 to the n. Now let's just presume for a moment that all the feelers have sort of equal cross-sectional area. That's not true, but suppose it is true. Then all these feelers are cut off by disks with exponentially small area. The area of this disk is like 1 over 2 to the n. So that means the length scale of the disk, again in the most standard picture, would be like the square root of that, which would be 1 over 2 to the n over 2. So we're seeing these small disks getting reflected in this bit of fixed. The reflected image of this small disk must go around the feeler. It's just like if you have a plane and you reflect in it and you have a disk on the left, its reflected image goes farther to the right than the plane. Well, farther to the right than the plane with the feeler means the reflected image of the disk which cuts off on the left must go to the right farther than the feeler extends. So what you're seeing is linear distances within this disk, which are exponentially small, this distance must somehow get some point here that's near the boundary. Remember, the boundary of this disk is fixed set. Some point within exponentially close to the boundary is sent harmonically far out to the right. And there's a technical point where the square root comes in, but the essence of the argument is just in the most straightforward picture, that's what you see. So if instead of talking about the conjugacy class, if we said, well, let's draw one being involution, see how much it stretches, we knew that perfectly well in 1982. But we didn't know that there was a better system of coordinates that would reduce the stretching. And that's what we now know. Now, I wanted to say that there are situations where wiggling something will actually make the...
We have a class here.
Sometimes conjugating by a rather wild homeomorphism can actually improve the regularity of a dynamical system. There are examples of this from Jenny Harrison's work. So I don't think there's a proof that goes, you just draw the most straightforward example and any conjugate of it will be worse. I think that, you know, that kind of comparison we don't know how to do. And maybe the last sort of context I'll give, and in seminar maybe I'll show details, but we know that in higher dimensions there are involutions, wild involutions of the 4-sphere, 5-sphere, 6-sphere that have non-flat fixed sets. We know that there are Lipschitz involutions which have wild fixed sets. So it's something very special in dimension 3, it seems, that being topologically wild implies non-Lipschitz. So I should stop here. Thank you.
Okay, I wanted to say two things before we let you know. I forgot, and you forgot to remind me. Mike is giving a physics seminar tomorrow at 2 o'clock in PMA 9.222, titled The Smallest Interacting Universe. Okay, so 2 o'clock, 9.2. And then on Wednesday, he's talking at Wednesday at 2 o'clock in our seminar, and Friday at 2 o'clock? Thursday at 3:30. And then tomorrow morning, Bob Edwards is talking at 9:30. Where is that?
9166, I think.
9.166, the 9-4 seminar. So you're welcome to come to any of those. But you had one.
Oh, yes. And if I looked up on the internet, there's a top rope climbing gym called Crux nearby. if anyone wants to join me one of the evenings I'm here, I'm going to try to make it out there.
If you're interested in joining us for dinner with Mike tonight, stick around for a few minutes. Maybe you can go outside.
Yeah, do it outside.
Maybe outside. Then we're going to head down. All right.
Great.